You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, all you wiretappers out there. We're in the studio, Gangland Wire. I'm here with my good friend, Cam Robinson from Chicago, Illinois. Hello, Cam. It's good to have you back.
Gary, I'm glad to be here as always.
I guess actually you're not from the city of Chicago. You actually live across the state line in Indiana. Is that correct?
I do. I live right across the border in Munster, Indiana, right around East Chicago. Those people who are up here know where the real corruption is, but I am right across the border from the Windy City.
All right. Now, do Indiana drivers always make fun of Illinois drivers and say they're the worst drivers in the world?
Well, the term I've heard used up here the most is FIDS, and the people up here from Indiana know what the last three letters are in. The last two letters are Indiana drivers. You can fill in what the first F is for, but that's what the local Indiana drivers tend to refer to each other is, and I don't even want to get into what we refer to Illinois drivers.
There you go. Same way you're in Kansas and Missouri. And if you're on the east side of the state, it's Kansas and Missouri and Illinois. So
we're pretty much aggressive towards any drivers who are not in our own car.
All right. Well, you know, first thing, don't forget to hit me up on my Venmo app. Buy me a cup of coffee. The code is GanglandWire. I've gotten a lot of people doing that here lately. Also, I want to thank Todd Hedges. He suggested that we do this story. He's from Indiana, and Todd, I appreciate you suggesting this. And I knew that Cam lived in Indiana, so I got hold of him and I said, let's do a little story on that. And he already had a really good solid background in that, so we put together a show. Now, Michael Norris, he got hold of me through Gangland Wire and said he loved our Whitey Bulger show, the kind of the angle we took on Whitey Bulger. I think that was the one with the prison guard who told us a little bit about what it was like to be a prison guard in a federal facility and how that could happen, which he now has. It's As the Key Turns. It has a YouTube channel. He now has a couple of shows up about how this Jeffrey Epstein could have gotten killed, and I've reposted those on my Facebook page if you're interested in that. He has a really good insight in how the scheme, how the systems work inside of a federal penitentiary. Joe Francis, he suggested we have a follow-up to Martin J. McNally, and I told him I keep in touch with Martin, or Mac as I call him. He's the skyjacker. He's working on a movie with somebody's doing a movie on him, the last I heard. I haven't talked to him and emailed with him for a while. I'll get back a hold of him. Doug Sissel, he suggested last week's show on Pudge Matassa. And Cam and I did a show on Pudge Matassa, which I thought was a really interesting show. We kind of, you know, do something a little more recent. Plus, we had the extra show, the little bonus show from Ben Ellickson, who gave us an insider union guy's view of the Chicago outfit and infiltration of labor unions up there in Chicago. So I appreciate Ben for doing that, and I hope you guys too. I thought it was really interesting insight. Anyhow, you know what I liked about Ben's thing? I don't know if you actually heard that one yet or not, Cam. He didn't just denigrate the mob. He said, you know, there was at one point in time, and I think he was talking about himself, there was a union guy who had a problem with the dental plan or one of the medical plans, and he went to his mob-connected union rep, and the guy just was real helpful and said, okay, let me take a look at this, and he made some calls, and then he came back and he said, here, you know, refill this or fill this application for benefits out again and send it back in, and he said, lo and behold, he got covered. So it's, you know, nothing is all good or all bad, as usual in life. But let's get on with our story on the Indiana branch of the Chicago outfit, basically. And when Todd asked me about this, I thought immediately that you know, this is so close to Chicago, it's got to be just a, Chicago likes to control everything they can. They almost controlled Kansas City and for sure controlled Milwaukee, I would say. Let's tell us a little bit about like the makeup of Chicago Heights, Illinois, which is where these mob bosses out of the outfit came from, and then over into Indiana. A little bit of that whole Northwest Indiana, Southeast Chicago makeup of people.
Well, Chicago Heights always had a major Italian population. There were more Central Italians, and they had their own setup, especially during Prohibition. They were brewing their own alcohol. When the great consolidation under Al Capone took place, because he was more of a South Sider, he reached out into guys like Jim Emery and Roberto in Chicago Heights, and he wondered if they would like to join his operation and conglomerate, and they were amenable to that. And Frank LaPorte was part of their crew. There's a famous picture of Al Capone reclining on a lawn. Frank LaPorte is, as you're looking at the picture, he's on the left sitting next to Capone. There's a woman in between them. And I think that meeting might have had something to do with the planning of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. It might have been accepting Frank LaPorte and his ascension into the leadership of Chicago Heights. But it was the Chicago Heights became an official crew as part of Chicago at that point. They always maintained a real individual identity. After LaPorte, there was LaPorte died in 1972, which was a bad year for the mob. You lost Ross Prio and you lost Paul Rica. But after LaPorte came Al Pilato, who was really respected. He was part of that Last Supper. And gambling and auto theft were big parts of their income. They ruled Lake County, northwestern Indiana, by default because they abut right up next to each other. That was ruled initially a guy named Gaetano Tommy Morgano. 1963, he got a gambling conviction, and there was a story about him trying to bribe a Portage, Indiana cop. And he was deported to Sicily. He took deportation rather than facing jail sentence. After that, a guy named Frank Zizzo took over, and he ran operations. He was between 1963 and 1988. Zizzo was, from what I got, he was pretty well liked by his guys on the Indiana border. He showed them a bit more favoritism. He ran a couple local restaurants, a place called Pepper Pot Pizza. There was one in Gary and one in Highland. I want to be careful. That was not Santini's Pepper Pot in Portage or Valparaiso. I know you've had to make distinctions in Kansas City, but this is not Santini's Pepper Pot in Portage or Valparaiso.
That's a good idea, Cam. We've got this Villa Capri thing here in Kansas City.
Villa Capri,
and
yeah.
There's this, I think actually it finally closed, but it's a really nice restaurant. It just happened to be named the Villa Capri out in suburban Johnson County. It's kind of upscale Italian. And so people always ask me about that. And when I was talking about the Villa Capri, I would always differentiate between the two. I don't want to cast aspersions on anybody.
Yeah, so not Santini's, but is the Pepper Pot in Gary and Highland. He ran a restaurant there. But when he died in 1988, his things were taken over by Bernard Snooky Morgano, who was the son of Tommy Morgano. But more control reverted back to Tootsie Palermo in 88. By that time, Al Tocco, who took over after Pilato, it was under indictment for a number of charges. His successor Pilato was under indictment in 82. Yeah, I'm mixing up my vowels here, but that was so. Tocco in Palermo took over. Tocco was the head of the chop shops. He was at war there, and then he was indicted in 88. His wife testified against him on the Chicago Heights side, and then Tootsie Palermo took over when Tocco was busted in Greece and sent back to America. Tootsie Palermo was a union official. He ran things with a guy named Gazzino. And They were not as generous to the Indiana side of the border, and there was some grumblings out of northwestern Indiana, out of Snooky Morgano and his nephew, a guy named Tony Leone, about how much money they were making on their gambling and a major construction racket they had going on up here. And then there was a major bust in 1990 taking down this big construction racket. But the major factor going on in northwestern Indiana throughout time immemorial has been gambling, from Merrillville, where they had Nunzo family the Nunzo family was had a major gambling empire, to the Bolito, the Puerto Ricans running Bolito out of East Chicago, and then you had the numbers and the policy rackets out of Gary and also East Chicago. So you had gambling up here, and of course there were the video poker machines, and there was a major video poker racket that was run by up into the political stratosphere of East Chicago, and a guy named Robert Pastrick, who was a political figure who ran this place with an iron fist.
Interesting. So kind of clarify, help me get this.
Yeah, I'm sorry I kind of rambled on. I have a tendency to do that.
Clarify this in my own mind. So you got Chicago Heights, which is actually in Illinois, and they're totally controlled. Well, Al Pilato, and he the guy that they tried to kill at like the eighth hole of a golf course.
Yeah, I believe that was 82 when he first was facing indictment. There was an independent attempt by some of his men. They thought they were doing the right thing. They told some of their individual underlings that this is sanctioned. We're going to take out Pilato because the bosses, Accardo and some of the bosses, are worried he is going to inform. That was not true. Pilato was well liked. You know, you were talking about some taps earlier about how appreciated Pilato was. And Chicago Heights was the largest geographic crew in the whole area, and certainly with the chop shops, they were making $30 million a year just on that racket, not counting gambling. So
yeah, and Alan Dorfman's office, they were talking about who, as IUPA is getting ready to go away, who will step on up. And it's kind of interesting, and I think it was the same one. Dorfman's indicating that he told Tony Spilotro that he should have come back a long time ago. He could have been what they call the heir apparent. And then they mentioned the guy on the south side, and from my understanding, that would have been Pilato. But that in they then the whoever he was talking to told Dorfman, he said, yeah, but he said that other guy, he'd go to war if Pilato would move up, or the guy on the south side would move up. And I think you speculate that might have been Angelo La Pietra, but he had his own problems at the time. These guys were going to jail for skimming from the casinos, but Pilato wasn't part of that. He didn't get any of that action, or if he did, it was indirect.
Yeah, that I forgot about the Pietro was in trouble at the time. That or Cicero. Cicero was the big crew also at the time.
So over in Indiana, then you got a whole separate kind of homegrown group of guys.
There's
the Morgano family, and who's now his son has taken over in more modern times after going through another guy, and they have their own pieces of action going.
A lot of with the gambling was the major thing going on there, and they had it all cleared through the local politicians. It was an exact microcosm of Chicago, and they checked in mainly through, and anybody from up here will know the history of East Chicago, and it's basically, they should just call it Little Chicago. East Chicago, the name is apropos because it's everything Chicago is, just in a smaller sphere. I mean, we were talking earlier, there had been 104 officials, government officials in northwestern Indiana that have been indicted or have gone into witness protection since, you know, in the last, I don't know how many years, but 104, and that's witness protection. So then
in that Northwest Indiana area, as far as the populations make up, it sounds like there's enough Latinos to support a Bolito operation, which I think I see in your notes here that Ken Ito helped run that, which makes sense because he was their guy on Bolito.
Yeah.
And there must be a large black operation to have a policy.
A lot of that. Yeah, between Gary and East Chicago, that was controlled. You've got a lot of that out of Gary, and a lot of it was controlled by a guy named Sonny Peterson in East Chicago. The guy named Puerto Rican Frankie Santos, he had every Latino gangster was kicking up to him. Had to pay 15% of their entire operation. So whether you were paying to the local, there was one guy, I sent you the story, a guy named Pee Wee Lozado. He was under this guy, Anthony Leone, and he was paying 10%. He was paying his street tax to Leone, but in addition, Lozado had to pay his 15% to this guy, Puerto Rican Frankie Santos. Because, you know, just because of his ethnic background. So he's, in the end, he's running his gambling operations, he's running his book just to make the payments that he's required to make just to run his book. So he's not making any money, he's barely paying his bills, barely scraping by. He's literally living paycheck to paycheck and not even that. Just so he can pay for the right to run his book. It was really kind of a funny, sad story listening to this guy. And he's crying on the shoulder of this undercover Gary police officer about how he's in really dire straits with these guys. And then the Gary police officer busts him with a lot of these guys and he went to prison for 3 years. He's got nothing out of it.
You got to love that name, Puerto Rican Frankie. No, you don't have to wonder where he came from or his family came from.
I think he was a Polish guy. I'm not sure.
I think you need to add a few more vowels or consonants in there to become a Polish guy. Isn't that interesting? All the kind of romance language, French and Italian and Sicilian and Spanish, they have a lot of vowels, and all the Eastern European guys have a whole lot of consonants in their names. Peanuts Pansko.
We'll
have to do a story on Peanuts Pansko. You people that are Chicago Outfit fans will know more than we know. Well, probably more than we know right now about Peanuts Pansko, but he was a character.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he got a little piece of everybody.
So what else? You got some other kind of funny stuff here where Al Roy Watkins, a lottery operator, turned federal witness.
He was a foreman. He and this Anthony Leone, who was sort of a lieutenant of Snooky Morgano, they were both foremen at the Gary Works at U.S. Steel, and they got laid off in '83. That was kind of when Leone got involved in the crime, and I got to be careful because as when Leone came out of witness protection in '91, he kind of turned his life around, and his relatives are up here, but. He got involved in lottery, and they started up this lottery with a $10,000 loan. In the beginning, it was making $600 to $700 a day, but it later turned around. It was making $3,000 a day, and 55% of every dollar was going to costs, and those costs were 15% to the mob, 10% to the cops, and 30% would go to the lottery winnings. And when they got heavy betting on a single number, they laid off the cost on the actual Illinois lottery. Pick four.
Oh, really? Huh.
So
how'd that work? Let me think. If
they would just throw if they got a bunch of numbers on 1, 2, 3, 4, they would just go across the border and they would bet the overflow betting onto 1, 2, 3, 4 and the Illinois lottery. So when the Illinois lottery paid off, that was when they would recoup their money.
If 1, 2, 3, 4 paid off, or that were the numbers, then they'd have to pay off, but then they'd win money with the money from the lottery.
The Illinois lottery as they used the I'm sorry, I should have clarified. They used the Illinois lottery as the pick numbers for their lottery.
Okay.
So they were guaranteed if, you know, so if the Illinois lottery hit 1, 2, 3, 4, then their lottery hit 1, 2, 3, 4. So they were guaranteed to win in the Illinois lottery. So a lot of times they just took all the money from their lottery and used it in Illinois lottery anyway. If they had a heavy day betting, they just put it all in Illinois lottery anyway. So it was, you know, for the most part, that was where they were getting all their money from the lottery anyway. So
then help folks understand and help me understand. I understand, like, on balancing the books with the football, where they're not really gambling when they lay off, like you got too much action on the Chiefs and they're playing the Bears, so you go to Chicago and you can lay off. You can find people that want to bet on the Bears. And so you'll bet on the Bears and lay off all that Chiefs action. So how does that work with a little bit more how that works with the lotto?
So
how do they make their money? I mean, in a sports book, I guess you explained how it worked. What I'm curious is how they make their money.
So you've got 4,000 people betting between a quarter and $50 on their lucky number. And people are real superstitious when it comes to lottery. They have a dream, and 1, 2, 3, 4 was in their dream.
Yeah.
I mean, when it comes to lottery, people are real superstitious. And they will bet insane amounts of money on these local lotteries because they feel that they have better, and Indiana didn't have a lottery at the time.
Okay.
So they feel as though this number is personal and this lottery is more close to home. So they bet this money on these different numbers on 1 through 4. So the odds are you're not going to hit it. So you've got all this money put in a pot. And
so the bookie, the pottery policy operator, then he keeps all that money.
He keeps all that money.
But then he has to save that. He's got to kick up to everybody, but he gets all that money. Then
correct.
Next
so two
week,
guys, if, two guys are running the lottery. So that's just two guys that take all that money. The mob gets 15% of it. So one person is going to win on whatever minuscule odds they give them. So they take all that money. Or they take whatever percentage the payout percentage was 30% of the take.
Okay.
So they would take their 45% of the total profits out, and they would take the 15% and give that to the mob, and the 10% and give it to the cops. So whatever was left, that 30% payoffs, that's what you would win out of the lottery for that day.
Okay.
30% of the total take, and then they would lay it into the Illinois lottery, and if that lottery hit on 1, 2, 3, 4, then that 30% pay whatever payoff is what you would give to the winner.
And that way they keep their books balanced just like football.
They keep their books balanced. They've already made their money. And, you know, let's say it, you know, let's say six people win 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, then those six people split whatever the 30% of the daily take was.
Okay.
So, and they don't get anything. Every bit of money that's been put on, and people were betting as little as 50 cents.
Yeah.
Every bit of money from this, as much as $3,000 a day has been put in, then you whack that up into only whatever 30% after the mob gets their 15, these guys get 45 and the cops get 10.
Yeah.
Whatever is left over, that's what's put into the lottery in Illinois. And if 16 people win, then you just split that minuscule amount up and give each 16 their share.
Okay, interesting.
And they've already made their money before the lottery's even happened.
Yeah, it's a poor man's way to gamble. It's a way to grab
absolutely.
That dream. When I first came on in the 70s, we still had a policy, and it was primarily in the black community. And I remember doing a raid once or walking. I guess I was a district guide, walked in after they'd done a raid down to one of the, I think maybe the Blue Front liquor store in the back room. That was a guy that what they call pulled the wheel. And it had these dream books. People would buy, I don't know where they bought them, but they'd buy these dream books that would have number things in them. And out of that, they would read those dream books. And out of that, they would, like you say, really superstitious about the numbers that they'd play.
Mob guys saw a lot of that
making money hand over fist off of that.
Yeah. A lot of that in the 40s with the policy wheels all over from Chicago to Gary. There were a lot, and then there were the policy wars with Sam Giancana taking things over from Teddy Rowe.
Yeah.
And I've done some writing on that. That was how Sam Giancana made his bones, so to speak, was he took over the policy wheels, and that was an insane amount of money, and that was what got him noticed.
Yeah.
Al Capone let them keep it.
Yeah, the whole South Side was primarily African American at that point in time, and it was a pretty lucrative thing. I remember reading about that. We did a story on Sam Giancana, I don't know, a year or so ago, 2 years ago, and I think he didn't even have to kill that Teddy Rowe.
Oh, he blew him away in the street. Well, yeah, Teddy Rowe put up a hell of a fight.
Oh, that's right.
It was Big Ed Johnson that fled. He kidnapped him, and then he fled with his family down to Mexico. He had a huge estate in Mexico. He was real smart with his money. He was a college graduate, and he was a hell of an interesting guy. And he was partnered up with these earlier Kelly brothers, and they had all put money away in Mexico. And the Kellys died of one of the Kellys had been killed, and the other Kelly died of old age.
Okay.
And Big Ed retired down to Mexico with his family and turned everything over to Ted Rowe. And Ted Rowe put up a hell of a fight against Sam Giancana in these policy wars, and then he was blown away.
Yeah, I think he actually shot Marshal Caifano's brother, and I can't remember his first name, killed him in the midst of all this. So,
yeah.
Well, they're not used to people fighting back like that very much, are they?
Mm-mm. No, they're not. So, but this poor guy, Al Roy Watkins, he ended up testifying against Leon because this was in the early 80s, Leon got tired of running this thing. He apparently had a very huge house in Valparaiso, Indiana, but he got tired of running the lottery, so he sold it to another lottery group for 10 grand. He didn't give Watkins any of this money, but he told Watkins, well, I tell you what, you go with him and you run the lottery. And so Watkins kind of realized that he was basically just, and he told these guys, Watkins is going to go with you and he's going to run the lottery. And these guys were like, well, that's great. We get the lottery and we get a guy to run it. And Watkins later told police, he said, he just sold me like a slave with the lottery. And it was that led him to speak to the police about this. He didn't like being sold and getting no money for himself.
I guess it's kind of like you work for a company and a bigger company buys it out. Remember, my wife worked for a little company which did pipeline tech stuff, and they did pipelines all over the United States, and they got sold to General Motors. So then all of a sudden they had all these new people came in, and they'd have these meetings, and they'd have, you know, rah-rah meetings and everything. She hated it. She said, I'm not a corporate person. She quit and went on to something else.
Yeah. Yeah, not a fan of that stuff. But then where you start to see problems is when Frank Zizzo dies in 1986. He paid his people pretty well. They were running the street protection in Northwest Indiana too. They were collecting for the gambling. Same thing you saw in Chicago. They were running it into Northwestern Indiana. As I've said, they had the political protection, and they even had the cops enforcing the political protection. And you had the gambling machines, the pinball machines, and all that, and you had the mob owning those. But so when Frank Zizzo, the Indiana guy, died, and these Chicago Heights guys, Tootsie Palermo and Gazzino, took over, they didn't even know if they were still going to have jobs or they were going to send new guys in. But their income goes down from, you know, $1,000 a month to $300 a month, and then they're missing payments. So they start to lose faith. And about that time, the mob is the Fed is running these major investigations into this major construction racket they've got going on. They're going around to construction sites and they're looking to see if they have basically. They're looking for kickbacks in order for these major construction projects. There was a lot of construction going on around Schererville, Indiana, and Dyer was getting big, and there was a major road construction going on. And they were like, "Are you up to date on your union dues? Are you paying into the pension fund the way you're supposed to?" Because they were responsible for collecting the money, and the unions wasn't set up to take cash, so you could give them as much money as you want, and this is $2 to $3 million over the course of the 80s that they collected. And the union officials later said at trial, we weren't prepared to take cash, so we just took them at their word and accepted whatever pension plan payments they gave us, and we knew that they were telling us the truth.
So they take that pension plan money and then convert a lot of it to their own use. Put some in a pension plan, but convert a lot of it to their own use.
And convert that into approval to perform construction. You know, we won't shut you down with I dropped my sheet here. We won't shut you down when you're doing this building, when you're building up Cherville, when you're running when you're expanding the roads up here. Because there was a big period of growth in northwestern Indiana that time. It was really, really coming into its own. And the way it looks now is not the way it looked in the 70s and all. I moved up here in 2008, but it really has blown up. I've talked to a lot of my neighbors and things, and that was a major period of growth. So that was a big time to be running construction rackets.
So is that what Altoco... went to jail, I see, and I have some vague memory of his wife testifying against him. And she the one that talked about Splatros, told the real story about the Splatros getting killed in Altoco. But was that the construction scam that he was going to jail on?
Toco was a real, when you think of like old school mob guys, Toco was it. Toco was going all over the country in his prime, killing people. He went up to Milwaukee and killed a mobster up there. He was responsible for a lot of Scarpelli was initially Toco's guy, and so Toco was doing a lot of killing, and the chop shop thing was Toco. He moved in and took over from Jimmy Guitar, and they had a rivalry going. The chop shops were initially Toco's, and when he got out of prison, he wanted them back. And I believe a lot of what he went under for were the murders and just basically being a pretty rough guy. I can't remember the exact charges. I need to go back and look into that. But I know murder was a lot of what he got, because he was running his mouth to his cellmate about, I'm going to kill my wife, and I did all these murders. And then his cellmate turned around and informed on him.
Crazy. Now, we talked about...
And they brought him back from Greece, you know. So it,
oh, yeah, they, that's right. He's the one they brought murder. Back from Greece. That was interesting. You don't get to hear that much stories like that anymore. And remind us all about, well, let's talk a little bit, it's kind of a subject near and dear to my heart. I used to sue a lot of car dealers for like selling a car with a washed title that was actually a salvage car. So the attraction for this stolen auto racket, chop shop racket, was partly they were stripping some of them out and selling the front ends and the doors and all that, but a lot of them they were retitling because of Indiana titling laxities.
Yeah, the title laws in Indiana were none, and there were no distinction in the laws at the time that even said automobile. So even in the chop shops, if for stealing car, you know, you could wash a title in Indiana, but even beyond that, if you stole a car in Indiana, there's so many cases that I found where guys would be caught up in these car theft rackets, and they would catch them dead to rights at a chop shop, line of cars stripped outside, and you would get busted on the theft, and you would get busted on the conspiracy, and they would plead out to avoid a trial. They would plead out to the conspiracy. They would get no jail time and a $1,000 fine, and they would walk. So you have a lot of that because Indiana didn't recognize auto theft per se. It was just theft. And you could steal cars across the border in Illinois, bring them to Indiana, wash the title, and and then take a wrecked car here, or a car that you would stripped, pop the VIN number. You'd steal a brand new car and cross the VINs, and then you're selling a new car. So in addition to washing titles in Indiana, because there's no difference in a salvaged car or wrecked car in a new car, you could also, even if you stole cars in Indiana, all you're going to get charged with was the conspiracy charge, because law enforcement was on because the courts and everybody were on the take, and you were going to walk. So there was no legal penalty at the time. It was really, when they say the Wild West, I mean, it was the Wild Midwest of car theft. So in Illinois really was cracking down, was starting to crack down into the mid-70s, but Indiana really had no interest. And I guess, as we have sort of talked about, between Hammond and Whiting, Indiana, and Portage, and over on into on towards Elkhart, there were 70 to 100 salvage yards just in that short span going up to the lake. And that's not a huge area that would require that many salvage yards. But you know, for, and even now there's garages. Auto repair places have moved in, but there's garages, multiple bay garages, where in the past guys would have rented out a single bay to just to chop shops for a month and then moved on to another bay. But there's so many garage bays and so many repair places now, because in the past they were just throwing up garages, renting them out, and using it for chop shops. It was cheap to build a building, because you're looking at $500 a day to chop a car. Yeah. In the 70s, that was big money.
That was big money. That was, you know,
that's big money now.
Big money ain't bad now, $500 a day. so tell us a little bit about their union racketeering activities. You kind of touched on that a little bit in the construction business, but they had, you know, our boy Pudgy Matassa, he had his own little union. So did they, how did they get into the union, laborers union, or were they part of the Laborers International up in Chicago, or they have their own union down there?
Al Pilato ran the union out of Chicago Heights, and Tootsie Palermo and Gazzino took over as union officials for the laborers. I talked to a guy who, I'm going to be careful, but he said the bricklayers were always a strong union. One of the local business agents down here had his house firebombed when there was some problems going on with a business agent, and he was kind of a bullish guy. His house was firebombed, and the FBI was investigating that in the late 70s or the early 80s. So anytime there was a union dispute, that's tend to be how it was settled. You would send, and guy I was talking to said, yeah, if there was a problem with a local construction site or a local company, if they weren't kicking in or whatever, they would send, he said, they would send us in there, and we would cut the heads off bolts, or we would set logs on fire. So they would use, a lot of times the rank and file would, and it was considered fair play, and you would just, if you would point them in the direction of scabs. And he was listing the weak and the strong unions, and I don't, because I have to live up here and my house is flammable too.
Yeah.
I need to be careful.
We don't need the most modern information on this.
I need to be careful naming unions, but as far, even into the early 80s, if you pointed in the direction of, and he sort of lamented that you can't be as strong on scabs as what you could in the past, but yeah, fires at work sites and slashing tires and breaking windows and that sort of thing was just fair play if your BA told you to go to that work site and hit it. They didn't need to have the mob guys do it. It was just you were told to do it, and that was the belief that you did. So it wasn't, you didn't even so much need organized labor if you had these BAs who were juiced in. And he did name several of the unions that were pretty heavy juiced in, and some of the ones that were not. And so they had permission to go in there and work over a work site, and then a week later they would turn around and it would be agreement labor in there. It was a rough place.
Really? So let's wind this on down now. I see you've got some little more modern activity. Some of these guys are going to jail. Anthony Leone, he seems to have decided to testify, which is unusual for the Chicago area. It gets anybody to testify. Frank Calabrese, Nick Calabrese was like the very first guy, I think, that was any import to testify.
Yeah, he was the highest ranked guy. You get a lot of these guys within the same first generation children of immigrants, that 1935 to 1940, guys like Sam Anarino and the Calabrese brothers and Petrocelli and a lot of all the Wild Bunch guys, Harry Alleman, those guys were the next generation, all the guys out of Cicero. And this guy, Leone, was in that group. He was running things. And once he started making less money, when Zizzo died, he kind of started losing losing faith, so to speak. You know, these guys, they're not as, we've talked about it, the idea that they're as loyal to the craft is not as true in real life.
But, that's the famous myth of the mafia. They'll take care of you.
Yeah, that's like your buddy Nick Sparrow said.
Yeah, I ain't no jockstrap. They use you until your stretch is all gone, and they throw you away.
So he rolled over. They were questioning him pretty heavy, and he rolled over on him. He went into witness protection in 1989. He testified against his uncle. Snooky Morgana was his uncle, and he told them all about the construction racket. He told them about making collections. He told them about everything. And Dominic Palermo, he ended up getting he went to prison for life. He was 74, and he got I had the amount of time he got, but he got a hell of a lot of time, Tootsie Palermo.
If he got any time at all at age 74, he's pretty much
he was done. And Gazzino got he got sent to prison for 16 to 17 years. Morgano got 16 to 17 years. Morgano got 16 years and $177,000 fine. Gazzino got 39 years and $185,000 fine. So these guys were done. The mob was for the most part smashed in northwestern Indiana when Morgano went away and Leone went into witness protection. Now Leone, who rolled over on everybody and went into witness protection.
He was a nephew of this Morgano, right?
Yeah, Morgano. And Morgano was the son of Tommy Morgano. Wow. So, that, you know, you get that same sort of Italian interconnectedness. And, you know, just anybody listening, my mother's surname is Stichetti, so any comments I make, I'm protected. I'm Paisan, so I am Paisan.
I'm all Peckerwood myself.
I can talk with my hands with the best of them, yeah. I'm okay.
Interesting quote about what Morgano said about his nephew. I like this. He's a snake. He lied on the stand. I do not ask for mercy. I ask for justice.
I do not ask for mercy. I ask for justice. So,
now, you know, I would rather have mercy than justice most of the time myself.
Yeah, you can take that nobility and stuff it. I want to get out of jail. But I will say, because Leone's family is still up here, he came voluntarily out of witness protection in 1991 because he wanted to spend time. He wanted to be with his sons for the holidays. He stayed out, and he was real active in the Special Olympics going forward. His son was in the Special Olympics. He turned himself around as much as we hear these guys doing that. He was a member of the community. He really contributed
Special Olympics. What did he do for a living? Do you remember? Did he have a business of some kind? Or
I want to say he went back to the steelworkers. I was reading his obituary. I think he went back to a union job, but I can't remember.
That
I
know makes he sense, came. Yeah.
I think he came out of the steelworkers, and I can't remember if he went back to it. But you know, so he did. He did. He voluntarily came out of witness protection to live in the same area where he was living that he testified. So I mean that's. That's a tough thing to do.
That is.
But he wanted to be with his family, and he supported them, and he stayed with them, and a lot of people did have good things to say about him. So to the Leone family, I am speaking to his good as well as some of his checkered past. So you know, don't come to Munster looking around.
Interesting. Well, Cam, this has been a great show. I really appreciate you jumping right into this and helping me with this. You know, folks, I'm really depending heavily on my friend Camulus Robinson, because I'm working on another movie. I've got a documentary. He's been helping me with the script. I've got the basic story down. I think I've done most of my interviews. It's going to be talk about the generation gap between the older mobsters. I'm interested in that because that's what we had in Kansas City, and that also happened in Cleveland with Danny Green.
Yeah.
So in Kansas City, we have these younger mobsters that are born either during the war or right after the war, and you got these older mobsters that were all either came over or their parents came over from Sicily around the turn of the century, and they were born 1915, 1920, and they're running everything, and it's the same way in Chicago. Those guys ran everything for a long time until these the post-war baby boomers or middle-of-the-war baby boomers became of age.
You had it in Prohibition, too. Same exact story.
Same story, wasn't it? The old mustache Pete's in a way, and you know, that's, you know, the whole Godfather story about that's when Nick Civella, you know, our guy in Boston, Kansas City, is born in 1916. Well, he raised up against the old mustache Pete's, and you had that all over the United States. So each generation has its young Turks, shall we say. And now I'm telling that story about the 1970s. We had quite a mob war. Bombings and murders, and then more bombings and some torture and some more bombings, and it was really it was brother against brother. We had two brothers, Nick and Cork Civella, were the kind of the ruling family, and they were born around 1915, 1916. We had four brothers, Nick, Joe, Mike, and Carl Spiro, and they were all born around 1940 to 1945 or 46. And they wanted a piece of the action, a little bigger piece of the action, and they were upstarts. And you know what really interesting I find out from FBI reports is this oldest brother, Nick, this is during the 60s, and he starts growing his hair out long. I mean, it was a generation gap, man. He starts growing his hair out long. He grows a big Fu Manchu. He wears bell-bottom pants and kind of flowery-looking clothes. I've got a picture of him in death inside the trunk of his car, and his pants are real flowery. I mean, they're real hippie pants, man. Yeah. And so we've got quotes from these mob guys going, you know, what's wrong with that guy? He looks like a hippie. And even the FBI reports to say his dress and demeanor, he became kind of persona non grata with the ruling family so much that, you know, they end up killing him. And that, you know, when as we came up with I'm not sure exactly, I think it's an old Sicilian proverb, is if you're going to kill one brother, you better be ready to kill them all. And this was a war to the death, wasn't it, Cam?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So
took no prisoners.
I'm spending. You guys, you've never made a movie, I imagine, and it is hard, and it is time consuming, and it's tedious. And I get into it, and I don't even think about what else is going on in my life till the end of the day for days in a row. But I wanted to knock this out real quick. I'm getting a little low after my month long hiatus in July. Get a little low on podcasts, and so this will knock this out. Now, if you would like to support that movie, see that coffee cup. If you'd send me $100, make a $100 donation, you'll get one of those coffee cups, a true Gangland Wire Crime Stories coffee cup. So, and you also get credit as one of the producers, you know. Now, Cam will get a bigger credit and a more prominent place at the end than you will for giving me $100. But I've got costs. I just ordered a bunch of illustrations from an artist to show some of the depict some of the murder scenes where no cameras could ever been filming. And I've got the audio. Last time I did a movie, I hired a guy and he charged me an arm and a leg, folks, to do the sound, but not only do the sound, but help with the music. And he did an excellent job. And I'm gonna pay a professional voice to be the narrator. I'm gonna do some narration myself because I was intimately involved with this whole story. Mm-hmm. I was on the streets during the whole time. But we're also gonna have a professional narrator to help explain this story And so there's expenses, and if you'd like to help with that and get a producer credit, and a coffee cup, send me $100 through the PayPal thing, and we'll take care of you on that.
Hell of an interesting story.
It is. It is heck of a story. Okay, I think we've done all we can do here, Cam, don't you think?
I agree. I think we ran it pretty well.
All right. If you have a friend or relative has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. Or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. Don't forget my movie, Gangland Wire. You can rent that for $1.99 on Amazon. I'm still getting quite a few rentals every month, and I think people are telling their friends about it. Now, if you'd want to buy that movie, you send me that $100, I'll send you a movie, too, along with the coffee cup with the special features on it. We got special that great features. Interview of the Las Vegas Intelligence Unit commander who went to Chicago and threatened to kill everybody in the outfit. Which is a hell of a story in itself. Again, I got my Kansas City Mob Tour app and the Apple Store, and then I've got my book, and I suggest you get the Kindle version because I hooked up all the wiretaps that are using that book that have the transcripts in the book for the skimming investigation. You can just click on the link and you go right to the actual wiretap, which I think is, there's nothing else out there like it. It's called Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. So we haven't got a title for the new movie yet. If anybody has a suggestion, it's about brothers killing brothers and a Sicilian vendetta, shall we say, between brothers, and we're batting titles back and forth. You got a suggestion, hit me up on, whenever you do that Venmo, when you buy me a cup of coffee on Venmo, you can send a little message, send me a suggested title. What do you think about that, Cam? All right, folks. Thanks a lot for
that's a way to get one.
Today. And Cam, thank you for helping me. I will talk to you later. Bye.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.